image. We're on Chanukah 2, Basic Judaism class, Chanukah 2. I'm just taping this. What do you see here? What is this? What's this image? What do you see in this picture? William, what do you see?
I've actually seen the color photo of this before.
Oh, you've seen?
Yeah, you can see the menorah, you know, and then the background is the Nazi swastika.
Okay, good. So this was, what night of Chanukah was this? Can you tell? Last night of Chanukah, it's the eighth day, because we light, you know, a candle every night. And the swastika is in the background. This picture shows a menorah on a windowsill in Kiel, Germany, in 1931. K-I-E-L. Kiel had a Jewish population of 500 Jews. 1931, the last night of Chanukah was a Friday night. The rabbi of the town, his name is Rabbi Posner, was rushing to light the menorah before Shabbat. His home was directly across the street from Peel's Nazi headquarters, where the flag, this is before Hitler came into power, 2 years before Hitler came into power, but then Nazi Party was already starting to, you know, emerge. And his wife, whose name was Rachel, took this picture. And she took this picture of the menorah with the Nazi flag in the background. And on the back of the picture, she wrote, look what I, oh, it's not here. No, it's not there. She wrote, Chanukah 5692. That's the year, the Hebrew year, 5692. It's now 5783. Okay, so that was 5692. Judea dies, thus says the banner. Judea will live forever, thus responds the light. This is what his wife Rachel wrote. I'll say it again. Chanukah 5692. Judea dies, thus says the banner, swastika. Judea will live forever, thus responds the lights. I thought I would begin with that image, because that's really what the menorah comes to symbolize. In the face of any kind of attempt to put down Judaism, like Antiochus and the Greeks were trying to do over 2,000 years ago, or the Nazi Party, which tried very hard, went to incredibly great lengths, allowed themselves to be put back on the battlefield to continue to kill Jews in concentration camps. And nonetheless, the Jewish people and the menorah continue to be lit. And the most important aspect of this mitzvah of lighting the menorah is two words that I want you guys to know tonight. Two words are called Persume Nisa. Lifarsim means to publicize, a nes. Anybody know what the Hebrew word nes means? Nes means a miracle. The reason we light the menorah is to basically reveal a miracle that not a lot of people maybe are aware of, which is why, where do we place the menorah? Where should the menorah be placed in your home? Ideally,
the window.
The window, so why? The whole idea is for people to actually see the light. It's not to create light in your home. Anybody know what mitzvah do we have as Jews that is intended to create light for your home? Shabbat candles. Good, we had a class about Shabbat a few weeks ago. And you're really supposed to put your Shabbat candles in a place where you'll have benefit from the light. So if you light your Shabbat candles and you stick it in the kitchen, and then you don't spend any time in the kitchen with the light on, you haven't really accomplished very much. The idea is to actually benefit from the light. Not so with the menorah. The goal of the menorah is not to create light in your home, it's to really create light that you project to the outside. And those really, I think, demonstrate the dual approach and values that we have in Judaism with light. Light represents the illumination of wisdom, of enlightenment, Torah, which is supposed to light up the world first within our own homes. We do that every Shabbos, to create light of the Shabbos candles within our home. And then Chanukah, that's why Friday nights, which is this picture over here, this was a Friday night, it was a Shabbat, you get to do both. You light the candles. Anybody know which one you do first? Do you do your Shabbos candles first and then the menorah? Or you do the menorah first and then the Shabbos candles?
The menorah.
Why do you do the menorah first?
I don't know the reason.
You can figure it out.
lighting match after.
Okay, because by the time, right, lighting the candles brings in Shabbat. What is one of the things that we refrain from doing on the Sabbath? Creating light. Okay, we're supposed to have light in our home, but that has to be created before Shabbat. Okay, so therefore we want to light the menorah first while we still can light it. You know what I mean? Come, join us. Welcome, welcome. Okay. So I want to share something else with you.
It's just one thing I want to know. Another handout, don't get freaked out by how thick this packet is. We won't be doing it all tonight. You can actually take this home. Actually, one little favor. You can take this home and do some reading on your own. I want to share with you some ideas.
From the late and great Rabbi Soloveitchik about Chanukah that we're celebrating. Any questions of anything I've said so far about the menorah? When is Chanukah, guys? When is it start? When's the first night? Yes, which is a Sunday night. So it's a week from next Sunday night. Okay, when's the best time to light the menorah, by the way? We said where to light it. Getting back to the where, let's say your view outside your gorgeous Manhattan penthouse apartment faces a brick wall, like many of our apartments do. So should you put the menorah there? Who's going to see it? Where should you put it then? So the ideally, I mean, if people can see it, not just birds, but like actual people, what's that? So some say, I don't know if you've ever done this, maybe you'll get thrown out of your apartment building if you try. So there's another way. You could either open up the door of your apartment, light the menorah, put it in the doorway across from the mezuzah, from your mezuzah on the doorpost. That way you're surrounded by mitzvot in both. Now some people might be freaked out about that. You don't want to keep your door opened for the half hour, hour, however long your menorah is lit for. But that at least gives you a little presume nisa, publicizing the holiday for the hallway. People walking around the hallway. I'm not getting a good response on this one. Okay. The other alternative is you stick the menorah right in the middle of your apartment where the most amount of people in your apartment pass, even if you're just living alone. Because to put it in a windowsill against the brick wall doesn't really accomplish anything. And the other tradition about lighting a menorah is, when do you do it? Day, night, all night, when? When's the best time to light your menorah? So the Talmud says you should try to light your menorah when it turns dark, so that's why people can see it, and as soon after as it turns dark, when there are people walking around the street. A little advantage to living in Manhattan, people walking around the street all hours of the night. The later it is, the stranger the people, I often find. But what was I telling you? Oh, so what happens if you come home really late from work? I mean, let's say you didn't get to light your menorah and you work till 10 o'clock at night. Can you still light? The answer is you can. You can light all night, technically. But better to light when there's more people about, out and about, to actually see your, to see your candles lit. Because it's about publicizing the miracle. Okay, so follow with me now. Has anyone heard of the great Rambam, Maimonides? Raise your hand if you heard of the Rambam, Maimonides. Okay, big rabbi from Spain, and then Egypt. He lived in the 1100s, 1200s. He codified all of Jewish tradition, all of the Talmud, and he broke it up into very neat, organized sections. Because if you ever studied Talmud, it's like listening in on rabbinic conversations between people. And it's kind of hard to find things. It's written in Aramaic. It's fascinating, and you should all learn how to study Talmud. But it's not easy to always follow, and it's not as neatly organized, as I said. So the Rambam put this together, and this is a section on the laws of Chanukah. It's got a couple of chapters, and I just want to read a couple of lines with you, with your permission. Is that okay? We're good? You with me? All right, so follow with me. I'll just read in English. In the era of the Second Temple, because remember last week, those of you who were here, when did the story take place? When did the Hanukkah story take place? Second Temple era, remember we had the Egyptians with the whole enslavement Exodus thing, and then who took over the Egyptians was the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, then the Greeks. And that's when we're living now, under Greek rule. The Second Temple has already been rebuilt for like two centuries already. And they come along in the era of the Second Temple. The Greek kingdom issued decrees against the Jewish people, attempting to nullify their faith and refusing to allow them to observe the Torah and its commandments. They extended their hands against their property and their daughters. They entered the sanctuary, wrought havoc within, and made the sacraments impure. The Jews suffered great difficulties from them, for they oppressed them greatly, until the God of our ancestors had mercy, delivered them from their hand, and saved them. The sons of the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, the high priests, overcame and slew them, saved the Jews from their hand. They appointed a king from the priests, and sovereignty returned to Israel for more than 200 years. Until when? Until who came along and destroyed the Second Temple 200 years later? The Romans. Okay? So getting a little history here. What is Maimonides teaching us here? He's saying that the Greeks issued decrees against the Jewish people. Now, those of you who were here last week, was it technically the Greeks who issued these decrees against the Jewish people? Who were these people? Don't we like the Greeks? Aristotle, Socrates, Plato. We quote these great philosophers all the time. Is this who these big bad Greeks were? Who were the Greeks that were trying to destroy the temple and trying to stamp out Judaism? Who were they? What's that? They were Hellenists. They lived when? Before or after Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and the like? Way later. What were you going to say? Okay, good. So, just so you know the technical history, Alexander the Great, who enjoyed a very positive relationship with the Jewish people, I mentioned last week a lot of Jews named their kids Alex, Alexander, because of positive relationship, but he, this is like 150 years after the death of Alexander the Great. And his Greek empire is split up amongst three different groups. One of the three groups is called the Syrian Seleucid Empire. Don't worry, I'm not being tested on this. Syrian Seleucid Empire, they're the ones who controlled ancient Judea, where our ancestors, the Jewish people, were living. They were the ones who were very keen on not only imposing political dominion over the areas that they conquered and that they ruled, but they were very intent on imposing ideological. The Jews were not the only ones asked to give up their faith. There were other ethnicities and other minority groups living there, and they demanded everybody give up whatever it is you believe, whatever it is you're living, whatever religion yet you practice. You're living under our rule, Hellenism. Be a good Greek Hellenist. And that's what was happening. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik, hang on one second. Rabbi Soloveitchik is one of the great rabbis of our generation, just passed away about 25 years ago. Asked the obvious question. And that is, we turn to page 180. It says when the Greeks ruled. We turn to the next page. He asked the question. Maimonides writes, it says when the Greeks ruled, Maimonides writes that Hanukkah occurred when the Greeks ruled, yet actually the wicked kingdom was not Greece. This occurred in the post-Alexandrian period. The enemy did not consist of genuine Greeks. There were another people who were assimilated to Greek culture and Greek language. In fact, Hellenism is very different than the Greek philosophy you and I studied. Maybe anybody studied any Greek philosophy, like Aristotelian logic and all that. That's not Hellenism. Hellenism was very pagan based. Okay, so Rabbi Soloveitchik is asking the question, says, why does Maimonides call them Greek at all? They're not really Greek. They were descendants of the Greeks. The Hellenized Syrians invaded the land of Israel. After the death of Alexander the Great, his empire disintegrated a number of provinces. The territory of Syria became a kingdom whose king instituted discriminatory laws against the Jews. But why do we ascribe these persecutions to the Greeks who lived hundreds of miles away? This took place in Syria. Is like where Israel is today, close to there. So the answer is simple. The Greeks were responsible for this cruel persecution because it found its source in Greece's intolerance and superiority complex. In the pre-Maccabean period, the Maccabees were the Jews who fought valiantly against the Greeks in the Hanukkah story. Before that, before the war broke out, Jewish history was confronted with a new phenomenon: religious persecution. It was a new, strange, alien experience. Preventing Jews from observing the law and making them violate the basic principles of Judaism was unknown in our annals. Before then, we had never met with religious persecution, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. So what kind of persecution did we have before the Hanukkah story? We had a lot, unfortunately, but it was not aimed at destroying our faith and our religion. It was aimed at what? What's that? Physical persecution for simply being a Jew. Of course, there was deviationism in Jewish history towards idolatry, but this was the first experience with persecution for those who wanted to observe. In fact, he says, many laws pertaining to Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name, and Pikuach Nefesh, saving a life, were formulated in the Maccabean period. Greek culture was responsible for this, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. Alexander the Great had a dream of conquering the world, but not for the sake of conquest and power. Alexander the Great was a philosopher. He was a missionary for Greek culture. He wanted to bring the Greek message, the Greek gospel, as it were, to every primitive barbarian or nation. Now, of course, they're not barbarian, but that's often the way people who colonize think about the people they're colonizing. The whole world was divided into two sects, two groups, the Hellenists and the barbarians. His job was to civilize the world. The British Empire tried to do the same. Likewise, Germany in 1914, during the First World War. When Germany declared war on England and France and Russia, I myself, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik speaking, was exposed to the missionary spirit to bring the Deutsche culture to the whole world. The Deutsche culture was the German culture. But Germany was trying to do this too, he believed. Not just trying to dominate the world, you know, militarily, but they had this Aryan belief system, and they were trying to eventually get everybody to buy into this. When people developed the idea of a mission to conquer the world in order to civilize it, religious persecution is inevitable. You know why? Because the barbarians don't want to be taught. The barbarians feel that their morality is as high as that of the cultured and sophisticated Greeks. So they refuse to accept the gospel that's offered by the Greeks. And what's the result? Persecution. This was true with regard to Christianity too. I don't know how familiar you are with Christian history. The Crusades, the First Crusades, the Second Crusades. They came and by sword forced people to convert to Christianity, which is a missionary religion convinced of its superiority, never doubting the worth of imposing it on others. Judaism is not a missionary religion. We do not want to bring our religion to the entire world. On the contrary, we are reluctant to accept converts. Had we been missionaries, we could have captured the world. Does anyone know this? There was a period of time when a lot of people wanted to be Jewish. Like, a lot of people. I know, you're like, really? Why are you so surprised? It's a great thing to be Jewish, no? During that twilight period, when Rome was about to shake off idolatry, this is 200 years after the Hanukkah story, hundreds of aristocratic families converted to Judaism from the Romans. Even the imperial family had many members who secretly, clandestinely professed Judaism. Had we been a missionary people, we would have actively proselytized Rome. And if we had done so, Europe would have been Jewish. Like all of Europe would have been Jewish. Indeed, I think quite often about what kind of Judaism would have evolved had we actually converted Rome to Judaism. Perhaps the history of the world and the destiny of humankind would have been different. All the same, Maimonides says, we cannot tell a non-Jew to observe Jewish law because the Jewish law was given to the Jew. All we can demand from other people is to observe the 7 Noahide commandments, which are the foundation of civilized life. Does anybody know what the 7 Noahide laws are? What are they? Anybody know? Yeah. But why are they named after Noah, by the way? Who is Noah? In the Bible. Who is Noah? Noah came before Abraham. So was he a Jew, even? Noah was not a Jew. He was a righteous person. So we call the 7 laws of Noah the laws that we believe every human being is supposed to observe. Not to kill, not to... What are they? Going to need 6 more. Not to kill. What's that? Not to tear off a living limb off an animal. Right, a prohibition of cruelty against animals. Good.
Don't worship idols.
What's that? Set up a court of law. Good. Institute a legal system in whatever society in which you live. Sexual immorality is another one. What are we missing? Oh, taking blaspheming God's name and believing in God, I believe, is one of them. That's 7. So these are basic ethical principles that we believe. Now, can we impose them on other people? I don't think you can impose anything on anyone, especially in our world. What we could do is we could teach, or we could, you know, best way of teaching. What's the best way of teaching?
Example.
Nobody likes a preacher. Kids don't like it when their parents do it. We don't like it. We become rebellious against people who tell us to live a life that we may or may not believe in. Even if we believe in it, there's a rebellious side of us that doesn't want to be told how to live or what to think or how to behave. So we have to... How do we model these behaviors, by the way? What's the document called that teaches us how to model Jewish behavior for the rest of the world? Called the Torah. Okay. The Torah is not a divine document of philosophy. It's a divine document of behavior. It's got 613 commandments, 248 things to do, 365 things not to do. And by living that kind of life, now of course it bespeaks a great philosophy, every one of those things. But ultimately we're supposed to observe a kind of life so people look at us and go, oh. Much more powerful than getting up on a soapbox and these black Israelites. I don't know if you've seen this. It's kind of a dangerous group. I just interviewed on my podcast, if you'd like to hear it, Dumasani Washington, who is a great African-American leader. He's a pastor. And he started, he wrote a book on Zionism in black America, and... does a lot of great work in the African-American community, and also is just, he's pointing out a lot of the anti-Semitism that's going on, unfortunately some of it coming from the black community. And this black Israelite group, which is very, very dangerous and growing, you should just be aware, they just met in Barclays like 2 weeks ago, and they've perpetrated a couple of anti-Semitic incidents already. One in Jersey City, one in Muncie. It took place right before COVID, if you remember. So it's a group to keep an eye on. But the idea is that any group that comes along and tries to completely impose its way by hook or crook on another people is always going to have people fighting back. And then the people who are imposing this view are going to have to always engage in persecution to get these quote-unquote barbarians to follow their ways. And he says that Judaism actually in history had the chance to convert an entire continent, to make Europe Jewish. By the way, just to give you a sense also, during the Bar Kokhba revolt, which was the last, this is almost 100 years after the destruction of the Second Temple, when we staged to date, in human history, probably almost the most successful rebellion against the very powerful Roman Empire, there were lots of non-Jews fighting alongside Jews, because they were enthralled with Judaism and they were fed up with the corrupt Rome, which was a brute force. They did a lot of great things too, these empires, in Greece included, but unfortunately the reality is that they imposed their will, their political dominion, and in the case of Greece, their ideological, what they believed in, and they wanted everyone else to conform. Alexander the Great, take a look at the next paragraph, 1122. Alexander the Great was the first missionary. He combined military tactics with Greek culture. He conquered the land, not only to control the land politically, but to implant Greek culture, Greek ideas, and Greek ethics. He failed, but those who succeeded him retained this idea of disseminating Greek culture and philosophy. The power of an idea, even though the latter is something abstract and unreal, is great. Ideas influence human minds and motivate people to act. Greek intolerance became the policy of the Syrians. Here are the Syrians, the Greek Seleucid Syrian Empire, who were the ones that were imposing these rules and laws against the Jews and other minority groups. Greek intolerance became the policy of the Syrians, which expressed itself in cruel and ruthless treatment of Judea. Of course, Judea resisted. Judea did not succumb. So religious persecution was initiated. Our refusal to comply with the missionary complex of Hellenized Syrians was the reason of their introducing religious persecution. He goes in, if you want to read this on your own, he applies this to what he saw from the Catholic Church. He says the same is true about the Christian gospel. Regardless of the fact that Hitler and his cohorts publicly professed atheism and practiced idolatry, New Testament anti-Semitism, hatred of the Jew, left an indelible influence and motivated the murder of millions of people, even though some Christian leaders condemned the massacres. The church was basically silent throughout the Holocaust, well aware of the atrocities that the Nazis were carrying out against Jews. The Vatican was silent. In fact, there were unfortunately many prominent Catholic leaders that instigated some of this. I once spoke at the same time, by the way, I don't want anyone walking out of here, you know, with the wrong impression. There were some great priests, Catholic priests, who hid Jews, monasteries, that I know people that were placed as children in Christian monasteries. They knew they were getting these Jewish children and they could be killed by the Nazis for harboring them, and they, at the risk of their own life. Our chazan, Arnie Singer, who now lives in Israel, he was our chazan for many years, he was on the High Holidays, he was here. His father, Polish, I'm thinking about this a lot, my daughter is in Poland right now with a group, and she's visiting the camps and everything, like, so she's been like WhatsApping me all these pictures, and so it's like very in my head right now. And Arnie Singer, our chazan, his dad, you should live and be well, he made Aliyah with Arnie, he's living there, he was hidden by a Christian family, literally under a stack of hay in their farm. Nazis came by on certain occasions. Other Poles, anti-Semitic Poles, come by checking around, and they would have been killed had they been discovered. And they risked their lives. So you literally had both. You had Christians who were part of the problem, and you had Christians who were saving Jews at the same time. And he goes to say, I once spoke with a member of the Catholic hierarchy in Rome about the Holocaust. He said that not only were the Catholics not responsible for the Hitlerian Holocaust, but they actually helped Jews during the period. And he kept telling me that Hitler was not a Christian, but a pagan. To say the Catholic Church stood up and protected the Jews courageously would be a gross exaggeration. Among the Poles, there were certain priests who helped Jews, but they were exceptions. The majority of Christians in Poland cooperated with the Nazi Gestapo. My daughter sent me a picture. I'm not saying these were Christians who did this. She went to a, it's on my wife's phone, so I don't have it here. I was just about to read it. She went to a mikvah. You guys know what a mikvah is? A ritual bathhouse. We have a mikvah on the Upper West Side here, beautiful mikvah. So they took, my daughter studying in a seminary for girls in Jerusalem, and they took all the women to this mikvah where Jews went for literally centuries to the mikvah. And during the war, women went to this mikvah. And until 2011, they placed a glass floor over the mikvah, and it was a discotheque. It was like a club, basically, until 2011. And they were well aware of this. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of anti-Semitism in Poland. And I'm sure there's some really good people, you know, Gentiles, living in Poland also. But it's still there. And Rabbi Soloveitchik continued, I'll just continue. He says here, in Italy, he says, among the Poles, there were certain priests who helped Jews, but they were exceptions. The majority of the Christians in Poland cooperated with the Nazi Gestapo. In Italy, the situation was better. The Italian priests were helpful, although this certainly was not true for all. I told him, he's having this conversation with a priest, I cannot argue with you about statistics. Hitler, may his name be erased, was surely not a Christian in the true sense. But millions of Christians, decent people, civilized people, cultured people in Germany, France, Holland, the Baltic states, and elsewhere, witnessed the slaughter of 6 million Jews, among them little babies. How is it possible to see the massive murder, the extermination of old men, middle-aged children and infants, and yet do nothing? It was due to the church. Throughout the centuries and millennia, the church preached that the Jew is forever cursed by God because he rejected Jesus, that he is to be condemned to be a wandering Jew, that he is responsible for the fact that Jesus had not returned. This is the concept of the Jew cultivated and implanted in the Christian by the church. Perhaps the church now realizes this is all a mistake, a terrible error. You know, this was changed. John Paul II said that this is no longer a church doctrine in what's called DSI, that the Jews are guilty of killing Jesus. But until that point, that was the doctrine. If it were not for the Christian doctrine of the wandering Jew, of Christ killers, and of deicide, Hitler and Holocaust could not have taken place. I told him, you're not directly responsible, but indirectly you are. And he then goes back to the Hanukkah story. The same is true with regard to the wicked kingdom of Greece. Greece was not directly responsible for the religious persecution, but indirectly it was Alexander's mission. The pride of the Greeks and their contempt for non-Greeks, that was responsible. Judaism has always looked for the father of the idea, not for the one who executed it. Sin is always attributed to the person who, even though he committed almost no sin, caused others to transgress, even if he meant well. Responsibility of a Jew for the deeds of a fellow man exceeds by far the responsibility for his own acts. This was the first time that the Jews met with religious persecution. And that's why Maimonides, as well as the authors of our prayer book, we say a special prayer on Hanukkah called Al Hanisim, look to the source and spoke of the kingdom of Greece. You say, technically, it's not the kingdom of Greece. It's 150 years since Alexander the Great was killed. It's the Greek Seleucid Empire. Yes. But Alexander the Great, he said, Aristotle, Plato, Solon, Pythagoras were responsible for what happened centuries later. They had what he calls historical responsibility. I'm just curious, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, great thinker, personality. What do you think of this? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you think it's unfair to hold?
So if you just have a question. You don't care too much what's going on in Africa. Are we going to blame the future, like by the genocide that's going on there? No.
What he's basically saying is that if you and I start spreading an idea, and that idea doesn't seem to be terribly dangerous today, but in 100 years it becomes very dangerous, and people start working off the idea that you and I started to cultivate and to develop. He's claiming that we bear some sense of responsibility and that we have to be careful, you know, because, you know, I thought I would talk about this just because of all the anti-Semitism and everything that's going on. You know, do we shut down? I'm not an advocate of canceling people, but do we shut down people who make jokes? that touch on anti-Semitic ideas, because it can be used somehow. So you say, well, you go to the other extreme and say, anything can be used. You know, Albert Einstein was a pacifist for most of his life, and his theories and ideas helped develop nuclear energy as we know it today. Now you could power up the world with nuclear, clean nuclear energy, and you could also develop an atom bomb and destroy millions of innocents. What would you say?
Be very benevolent and nuts.
Well, he was conquering the world, according to Rav Soloveitchik, because he was a philosopher and he wanted to impose a certain ideology on the areas, the territories that he had conquered.
Sure. But if you think that ideology is so important to impose that you need to preserve violence, then maybe other people using you as an inspiration for their violence isn't that far off.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. That's a great point. What do you guys think? I'm curious what you guys have to say.
It's not that. Like, Alexander the Great stuff, it's not that different from what the founding fathers and the best destiny is that we have the greatest bloodline of philosophy. And I'm not even disagreeing with that, but ultimately, that brought back some of these great stuff.
Right, because now what's the difference between, let's say, the way the founding fathers went about this? They used violence to break off from the Church of England and create independent colonies. You know, which eventually developed into these United States, but they weren't imposing by, you know, they said this is what we're going to set up, this republic according to these certain ideals. They're not putting a gun to everyone, you have to live here. If you want to live here, this is the way we're going to live. It's very different than going to some other country, okay, going to some other country with your particular ideology and saying, you know what, the way you guys are living and thinking is all wrong. We're going to bring a new way of thinking, and if you don't subscribe to it, too bad, so sad. So that was, I think that's the difference, though. The question is, you know, there's a famous line from the rabbis that you have to be careful with your word. You never know the way what you say and what you do in life is going to be interpreted and used by other people. But I do think it comes down to intent. Because if I'm saying something completely innocent and I'm really doing it for a good, peaceful purpose, somebody then takes it and uses it for, I mean, how can I control that? But that's not what Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying. He is saying that it was Alexander the Great's philosophy to impose, and that's what was picked up by the Syrian Greek Seleucids in the Hanukkah story. And that's why this whole thing, by the way, is just a commentary to explain why Maimonides blames the Greeks for the persecution of the Hanukkah story. Why would you blame the Greeks? It's much later. It's the Syrian Greek Seleucids. Ah, but they're descendant of the Greeks, and that's where they got this idea from to impose. That was his point. Any other comments, questions about this issue? Yeah, please.
It reminds me, I forget the guy's name was. The radio lab about this like German Jew, he's the guy who figured out how to like capture nitrogen and fertilizer, which is like, you know, feeds billions of people. He also is the one who like figured out how to use mustard gas in World War I against Germany's enemies. And like that discovery is what they eventually like opened up and created like Zyklon B in the concentration camp.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like a German Jew actually invented like what became eventually Zyklon B, like an odorless version of it. It's just kind of a similar, that wasn't his intention for it, but he did have kind of intention.
Well, if his intentions were to create some technology that could be of use and had no knowledge of how, well, I don't know, did he know that this could also, that's what every like superhero movie is about. You know, like it's this certain technology, and if it gets into Superman's hands, we're okay. If it gets into the Joker's hands, we're finished.
in this case, like, he did create, like, a chemical warfare, like, on behalf of Germany, so it was, like, that interest was there, but he also did amazing things, and obviously no idea what he turned.
Right. By the way, that is a very important Jewish teaching, because almost everything in life can be used in different ways, the same energy. Right? We have energies. You ever hear this term, the Yetzer Tov versus the Yetzer Hara? We have a good inclination, we have an evil inclination. It's all energy. Question is, how are we channeling it? God gave us all certain predilections, predispositions. Some people are a little more easily angered, some people are a little more chill. How do you use that? Because you can use your passion that could otherwise go in a negative direction for something really positive. And you can use your chill. It's always just a question of how you channel. It's all about channeling. The Talmud says that if someone is overly aggressive, they should become a shochet. Like a ritual slaughter, a butcher. Meaning use it in a direction that, you know, it can somehow be purposeful and productive. Because it is an energy that you have. The question is, how do you channel it? So that exists on the internal level. Let me just take one or two other ideas and we'll finish up. Take a look at the next line in... We said before that... just back to the original line there on page one. It says that they refused to allow the Jews to observe the Torah and their commandments. So if we turn to page 185... 185. Oh wait. You know what? It's the pages are messed up there. Don't worry, we're finishing up anyway. So what does it mean that Maimonides says that they refuse to allow the Jewish people to observe the Torah and their commandments? The language in the Hebrew is la'asok. La'asok means to involve yourself, to immerse yourself. And that's actually the word that we use in the morning when we recite the morning blessings. It's actually on the same... I'll just read this part here, I'm sorry. The Syrians tried to prevent the people from commitment rather than study. They wanted to extinguish the flame of devotion and all-out dedication to Torah. They prohibited Torah education rather than Torah study. What's the difference between studying something and being immersed in it? Studying something versus being immersed in it. Yeah. What's that? We're not immersed in it. Okay, studying is about, was that what you were going to say? Or something else?
Being immersed is living.
You're living it. As opposed to reading about it. Those are two different things. So the goal of a Jew is to really live their Judaism and not just learn about it. You came tonight to class to learn about Judaism, but for the goal of incorporating this into our lives. What were the Greeks trying to do? They were trying to prevent more than simply studying. They were trying to prevent people immersing themselves in this. They prohibited Torah education rather than Torah study. They did not care about scholars isolated in their respective corners. They cared about dynamic scholars teaching Torah. You ever been to a Beit Midrash, a Jewish study hall? Has anyone ever been to a yeshiva? You ever walk into a yeshiva in a study hall? You see people standing on their feet yelling and screaming at each other. Very different than a library. You walk into a library, you go reading. Be very polite, respectful. What's going on in the Beit Midrash? They're arguing. They're grappling. They're immersing themselves in this thing. It's not simply academic. Now, this is also very interesting over here. One last thing I'll mention. It says, and I don't know if you picked this up, that they extended their hands, the Greeks extended their hands against Jewish property and against their daughters. What is that referring to? So that's kind of what I thought also. If you take a look on 186, they lay their hands not just on their property, but also on their daughters. That brings us to a basic principle in Judaism, which is called in Hebrew, tzniut. Has anyone heard of that term? Tzniut means modesty, sexual modesty, and morality. No other moral norm is as central, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, and as important in Judaism as that of sexual modesty. Judaism held the view that human dignity and majesty can be achieved only through protecting sexual morality. If the latter is abolished, then man, no matter how agreeable and creative, forfeits the extra existential dimension that the Almighty granted him. If we allow our sexual modesty, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, to be violated, which is what the Greeks were trying to do, then it forfeits this extra existential aspect of who we are. Moral laxity and looseness makes man retreat. This is very existential language he uses now. He was an existentialist. Moral laxity and looseness makes man retreat from the human to the natural kingdom, replacing a meaningful life with a mechanical pressure and push. Moreover, while the brute does not cheat nature, modern man steals pleasure that comes with the gratification of the senses without accepting responsibility. It's a great line. You hear that line? While the brute does not cheat nature, modern man steals pleasure that comes with the gratification of the senses without accepting responsibility. There is something else involved. Not only does the voluptuary lose its humanness and kindness, he somehow defiles his existence. There is in human existence a quality of cleanliness and purity. While we are aware of our existentia, we experience exaltedness, something clean and pure. It's difficult to describe the category. Only one who's lost it is capable of explaining what this positive experience of puritas, which is Latin for purity, is. Its absence results in a hangover, a feeling of being contaminated. If anyone's been in that situation, it's not just that you drank, you're just disgusted with yourself on some level. And it's a sense of forfeiting an aspect of who we are. The Torah held the view that a woman's stake in sexual morality is greater than a man's. The woman stands to lose much more because of sexual morality, immorality, than does the man. She can lose her dignity to such an extent that the male with whom she sinned holds her in contempt at best. At worst, he hates her. He looks upon her as if she was an object made for one purpose, to gratify his desires. He quotes some verses from the Torah, and Rabbi Soloveitchik explains why is this? Because a woman, according to Kabbalah, according to Jewish mystical tradition, is endowed with an aspect to her personality that a man does not have. A woman's loss is greater because, and here's the line, a couple lines down, Natan HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bina Yitera V'Isha. God has given a woman what's called Bina Yitera. Now, Bina is an aspect of knowledge. A woman has an innate sense of knowledge and wisdom that we believe is absent in a man. And as a result, her loss, and it's somehow connected to sexual morality as well, which is very, very interesting. I was once sitting with three other MGE rabbis. We were trying to figure out what to do about something, and we were just at a loss. So we made a pact and said, we're all going to call our wives, and we're all going to ask them what they think. And then based on, we had a little majority thing amongst, it was five of us together, and we wanted it to be like not even. And we said, we're going to follow, because women are invested in what's called in Hebrew, Bina Yetera, an additional insight. Just sort of, it's not an intellectual thing per se, it's almost a feel, a natural intuition, if you will. And somehow it's connected with what Rabbi Soloveitchik describes as puritas. He says, well, her loss is greater, and the wound is therefore more painful than that of a male. Therefore, the Torah was more concerned with the sexual life of the woman than of a man. Many ignorant people misinterpret this and accuse the Torah of being male-oriented. The reverse is true. Judaism believes that the division of man into male and female is not to be understood exclusively in physiological terms. Men and women, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, are different, not just physiologically. Their personalities are different. Men and women differ in their personalities. Women's personality is much finer and more delicate than man's. She can endure more. She has intuitive depths of which man is unaware. She can also lose her personality quicker as a result than a man. The finer, because the finer and more exalted the personality, the easier, the more fragile it is. The attempt to desecrate the lives of the males was not as horrible as the desecration of the women. Usually our enemies knew what to attack. They had a satanic intuition and assaulted our central institutions. The quintessence of Jewish history, not only in the past 1900 years, but also since the establishment of the Second Commonwealth, is always in opposition. And I'll end with this, but it's actually very, very connected to what's happening today in anti-Semitism. He goes on to say that sophisticated anti-Semites always knew better than to simply attack the Jew directly. What you do is you go after a Jewish institution, and that's more acceptable. Back then, it was the temple. That's what the the Greeks were trying to destroy. Before there was a battle, they were trying to defile the Jewish temple, because the temple represented the Jew for almost 1,000 years. That was the central institution of Jewish life, both temples. And later on it became, he says, the daughters of Israel. And now he says, if you skip down, he says the church, it was the Talmud. That's why there were public burnings of the Talmud in Europe for centuries. I don't know if you've ever seen or heard about this. In France, there was a terrible, one of the things that we talk about on Tisha B'Av was a burning of wagons filled with manuscripts of our Talmud that they would publicly burn. He says that this was what we united the entire people. Our enemies understood that at the time we could not have survived as a people without the temple. That's what united the entire people, from the farmers of the Galilee to the workers of Jerusalem. But during the 200 years after the Hashmonaim victory, we developed the ability to survive without a temple. As Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai realized when he requested Yavne over Jerusalem, and then Talmud and scholarship and Torah study became like the replacement for the temple. And that's when they started burning Talmuds, because that was the next object that was associated with the Jew. Right? Later in the Middle Ages, the church hated the Talmud, which became the symbol of Jewish uniqueness. Now, what is it now, guys? Now it's Israel. If you want to get away with saying something anti-Semitic, attack the state of Israel, because it's a foreign government, and no foreign government acts perfectly. So I'm sure there's some legitimate critique of Israel's policies, particularly when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian question. So that's fine. By the way, we all do that. Plenty of Jews, you know, verbally will be critical of its government's policies. If you're on the left and you don't like the right government, if you're on the right, you don't like the left, the government's too left. But there's a difference between that. And I argued this, I was just on a panel on anti-Semitism. I said there's a difference between that and calling Israel an apartheid state, or calling Israel a Nazi, the new Nazi Germany. Okay, because that's just saying that Israel has no legitimacy. And that's fluffing over the complexity of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is not a simple situation. And it also completely dismisses everything Israel has and continues to do to achieve peace with her neighbors. Doesn't mean she's always made the right decisions and that she's always doing the right thing. That's never the case with any government. But to say apartheid, that to me, that's anti-Semitism, and that's much more acceptable than saying the Jew. Who was the comedian on SNL? Chappelle. Right, Dave Chappelle. So he made that comment, by the way. He said, you can't say the word, he was being critical of Kanye West. He was saying, you can't say Jews or the Jew and then follow it with something like that. He goes, you got to stay away from that. And he was right. Okay, because people understand that that's not acceptable. But you can say something nasty and disgusting and untrue about the state of Israel as a way of really expressing a deep-seated hatred for the Jew and get away with it and get a pass. And that's unfortunately what's happened a lot, right? The right-wing anti-Semites don't get a pass, okay? The white supremacists, there are enough people who hate them and see how dangerous they are. But this is not, I'm just giving you my opinion, I don't mean to get political, but this is sort of bringing up the issue. But the anti-Semitism today coming from the left, which is attacking Israel without any kind of nuance or understanding of the complexity of the situation, is just as dangerous, maybe even more dangerous, because it gets a pass. because it's a critique of another government. But that's not a legitimate critique. Legitimate critique is you should have done this as opposed to that, and I understand this, but this could have been better, blah, blah, blah. Not apartheid, okay, which is clearly not the way if anyone's been to Israel and understands the situation. And again, it's complicated. And I think that's a very, very important. It says, now the object of hatred, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, is the state of Israel. The anti-Semite cannot simply attack a Jew. He needs a certain object of hate. We have lost many. Not too long ago, we lost 6 million, or one-third of our population. But on the whole, we have emerged victorious. We still retain our identity. We are still committed to the same goals to which our ancestors were committed millennia ago, and we still assemble and study the Torah, as we are tonight. And there wrestled the man with him until the breaking of the day. We do not see daybreak yet, but the morning star will finally rise. Oh, any comments or questions? I know this is a heavy class. You can feel free to disagree with me or share a different point of view. Any Hanukkah questions, concepts, ideas, please feel free. I know this is very heavy. Yeah, what do you think we should do? Why are you laughing? Yeah, what do you think we should do? Yeah. I mean, it goes back a long ways, right? What were you going to say?
Education is, I think, is the best tool, but I don't know.
So that was one of the reasons for sharing all that with you tonight. Because I don't know how many of you, I'm just curious, how many of you are familiar with this, with the kind of history of anti-Semitism that's been going on from the church and from other places, the Greeks, the Romans. This is so old. And it manifests itself. So when you say education, so how? How, educating us or the rest of the world?
I think us first.
Yeah. Yeah.
We learn our own history.
Yeah, if I had my druthers, I would. Well, you can't force anything we said tonight, right? But I think if we were more knowledgeable, all of us, on just even modern day Israeli history, we would have a greater ability, I think, to articulate Israel's case, and not claim that she's always right. That's not true either. But to be able to counter. When somebody makes a remark like that, Roger Waters, the Hadid sisters, all of these, you know, Adidas, when they dropped, help me, who they dropped? Kanye West, they didn't drop the Hadid sisters, who call Israel an apartheid state, and Roger Waters gets a pass all the time. I was a big Pink Floyd lover growing up. I have a hard time listening to his music right now. And I get somebody, you know, making a rational like argument why Israel is not dealing with the Palestinians in the best possible way, have a conversation, but I would start with that kind of education, so people can see that it is no different than the anti-Semitism that comes from the right, and that starts with the two words, those Jews. Because when you say Israel, it doesn't sound the same. It doesn't sound quite as difficult to bear.
There are coverts on the right, globalists, George Soros, you know,
yeah.
They're acceptable. And I feel like a lot of the stuff with Kanye was they were all like, okay, we can get with this guy, go with Tucker Carlson. But then a couple of weeks later, he goes like, no, I like Hitler. And I feel like that's that. No, you're not supposed to say that part.
I wish he hadn't. Because then people just write him off as a mishugana,
yeah,
as a crazy guy.
I'm not sure about this, because if you ask a left guy, you give a lot of arguments why the right's better or the vice versa. It's behind the rational thing. It's based on your belief, it's based on your emotion. So it doesn't matter if you present rational arguments.
Right.
The emotion is there. And one change, only if you want to change your emotions. So behind this...
So how would you... So I very much agree with that. I think getting too much
so
into their arguments...
the intelligence of each one of us. Otherwise, based on arguments, you say the world would have more hate. People won't be angry. No, you still be angry eventually because you have emotions and it will come So it's more like something that will always happen.
Right.
There's nothing to do. It's inside of you. You're going to have your beliefs. It's going to trigger emotions. It doesn't matter what someone says to you. It's not going to change. So it's more like your personal growth.
Mm-hmm. You know, my dad always told me this story that
we're,
I hear you. At the end of the day, if we get too much into why do they hate us? Why does this person? So then I say, oh, that's the reason. So I'll turn myself into a pretzel and become something that I don't think this person will no longer hate. That's always the danger, because there is an emotion behind it. Like any form of bigotry, anti-Semitism is irrational. It is. Even though they have a reason. But everyone's reason is different. So which one do you think is the true reason? Because then that's what Jews did over the centuries, right? We're not loyal enough citizens. I'll become more loyal. And then we get really loyal. We took over the banks and we run Hollywood now. Now we're too close. Which is it? So I agree with what you said. I don't think there is a rational basis. But hate can be learned, is learned. And then, are you going to say something? No, please. Well, do you think there's so? I mean, there are some self-hating Jews, I guess. But you're going, you know, two Jews, three opinions. That's not going to change. You know what I mean? We're never going to. How would you suggest we go about doing that? You know, short of forcing everybody to believe in the same thing. We don't. We have legitimate arguments with each other as to how to interpret Torah, Judaism, how we should live. You know, I mean, I agree with what you said. I think, unfortunately, you know, like you said also, Justin, we have to start within our own. Because if we really love, you know, they say they tell the story about the Jew who stands up for the black professor on college campus, the black community, and for the gay community, and for the this and that. Everybody except his own people. And that's unfortunately a situation. We're lacking a certain pride in who we are. And I guess if we were a little more proud, you know, then maybe we'd feel a little more cohesive. But I feel like am I in a little bubble here? But I thought we were a pretty tight-knit people. You don't think so? You don't think so? What's that?
I'm with you. I think that's how we overrepresent ourselves in pretty much every industry in the world, because it's just because
we take care of each other.
Yeah.
You don't feel that so much.
I feel like there are several Jewish communities that take care of you
if you're in there.
But the issue that we faced historically is that we are often scattered, right? So it's like if you're already in a Jewish community and you're raised in a Jewish community and you have some sort of like you resonate with that community, yeah, sure, it would be very tight-knit.
Yeah.
For me and for a lot of the Jews that I knew growing up, it's like if you don't have an immediate synagogue that's like, okay, this is where I'm comfortable, or like you have a group of friends that are Jewish and this is where you're comfortable, it's like your only exposure to anything that could be fun or welcoming for Judaism might be forced on you by your parents or might not really be very accepting. And there are so many different types of Jews that it's like, okay, like, oh, well, Reforms aren't Jewish enough, or Hasidics are too hardcore and they're crazy. And it's like, you know, I don't think that we're really very unified. But that's also kind of why I like this, because this is one of the most accepting experiences I've ever been to. You know, speaking as like someone who has struggled with trying not to be a self-hating Jew, like, I'm always nervous going someplace that you might not be welcome, right, that you might be judged in a way for not being Jewish enough, or for whatever. This has been wonderful. So, like, I feel like this.
I mean, I wish I had a video camera on you right now. This would be helpful. This would be helpful with our donors. What's that?
That's
So I guess what I'm hearing a little is, Anya, are you going to weigh on this? That, like, if you're in a community, you feel that tight-knittedness and you look out for each other. But if you're not so much in that, then you don't necessarily feel like on the outside a little. And then we're not so tight-knit in that regard. So it really depends who you are and where you're, you know, if you're really part and parcel of a growing, thriving Jewish community. That's an excellent point. You're going to... Yeah. So how do you deal with that, the fact that we're not all living in, like, shtetls anymore? You know what I mean? Now, we are. The Upper West Side's like a little shtetl, I guess, in its own way. You know what I mean? Because what you're saying is that if... And that's normal. Like, if we're spread out... They said that was a problem with the Purim story. That there were 127 provinces in ancient Persia. And the Megillah opens up that Haman, who was the villain in that story, he... when he was trying to convince the king to approve his evil plot to annihilate the Jews, he says there is this one nation, Mefuzar u'Mefurad, scattered amongst the provinces, which is another way of saying to Achashverosh, the king, he was trying to get the royal insignia to approve his plot to kill the Jews, don't worry, they're not going to look out for each other because they're scattered. How do you create that kind of cohesiveness if you're not living amongst each other? It's not so simple. Say again? Right. Putting the work within the community, 100%. I mean, you basically described why we started MGE 23 years ago, was to really create a certain cohesiveness where there isn't. Even here in New York City, so many Jews, right? But how many Jewish people actually feel part of a community? I don't know the numbers. I don't. I think there are a good number of Jews who do, but a good number who don't. So that's an interesting point. So maybe this, maybe something positive will come out of this anti-Semitism. You know, if we could start thinking about our own internal feelings for each other. How proud we are to be Jewish or not. And that's going to come down to the community to which you belong or not. That's an excellent point. Yeah. In New York?
In New York.
Uh-huh.
I've been working for 8 years, still can't speak it. went the non-religious route throughout college, whatever, and then I was faced with an instance of anti-Semitism, and then I decided to get back into it. So there is some light that comes out of all this.
In other words, the anti-Semitism inspired you a little to go a little more internal. You know, you know Alan Dershowitz, he spoke at one of our events years ago. And he, I guess things were not as bad anti-Semitism-wise. And he said to me, he says, anti-Semitism has kept Jews Jewish for a long time. Think about it. Because when someone, you know, pushes against you, the natural response is to, even if you don't care so much about it, all of a sudden you care about it. You know, and he said to me in front of like 500 people, he said, it's going to be up to you rabbis when there's no more anti-Semitism to like demonstrate why Judaism is worth keeping, even if no one's putting a gun to our head. Now that's a sad commentary a little also, because there's so much worth here, and we don't have to be, but anti-Semitism sometimes reminds us, it does, you know. What I was going to say before, and I'll end with this on a more positive note, keeping it smiley and happy, even though what you said was, I really appreciate the comments, So my dad grew up in a little hick town in Pennsylvania called Oliphant, Pennsylvania, whatever. And he came home from school crying one day because some kid got a new bike in his class, a bicycle, and everybody was trying out the new bicycle. And my dad tried it out, wanted to try it out, and he's like, "No dirty Jews on my bicycle." Dad came home, was like seven or eight years old. My Zadie, my father's father, blessed memory, who came from Bialystok, Poland, he said, "What's the address of the boy?" He says, "We're going over there together." And my Zadie was a very straight, tough guy. Knocked on the door. Father of the household came to the door and said, "My son told me that your son wouldn't let him play on his bicycle because he didn't want a dirty Jew on his bike." No 8-year-old knows that by themselves. He had to have learned it somewhere. You think that's the right way to be raising your son? And he was like really taken back. He apologized. And my dad ended up having a very nice relationship, believe it or not, with that kid. That has a happy ending. They don't all have such happy endings. But the point I wanted to make is that, you know, hate is learned. And it can be unlearned. And it's all education. It's all about what we teach the rest of the world, but it's got to start with us. And I think by learning more about Hanukkah, understanding this was not a hate of Jews per se, it's a hate of Judaism, whatever, fine. And understanding our history, our rich, incredible history, and being not only aware of it, but knowledgeable and internalizing it and being proud. And I'll end with this because it takes me a long time to end. I'm really going to end now. But Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, of blessed memory, he was the former chief rabbi of Israel, of England, of Great Britain. And he said that non-Jews are embarrassed of Jews who are embarrassed of their faith. And Jewish people and non-Jews are often respect. They may not agree, but will respect Jews who have pride in who they are. Right? You make jokes about your own religion, about your own this, and, you know, poo-poo it, and it's not a big deal, I'm just like everybody else. That doesn't breed respect. What that does is that just makes it like you're not taking it that seriously, and so why should anybody else? That doesn't mean we should wear Judaism on our sleeve and be antagonistic against other people or other religions, God forbid. But it just means we have to know who we are. And I think the more we know who we are by studying and learning, as you guys came tonight, celebrating Hanukkah and all the holidays and doing it with not just because they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat, but because we really have a deeper understanding of what it's about. And we actually find value in it, even if we're not being persecuted. We'd be here anyway, because it's so awesome. That's ultimately, I think, what is going to give us the strength that we need to combat our enemies. And I want to end on that positive note. Next week, Leah, what do we got going here next week?
We actually have a happy hour for Hanukkah.
Happy hour for Hanukkah.
At a bar downtown.
A bar downtown called the Gem, what is it?
The Gem Saloon.
It's a pre, that's to get you ready for Hanukkah, okay? And then on Hanukkah itself, which is the 21st, we're going to be having a Hanukkah party here on this floor. So we hope you guys will come and celebrate with us. I also want to invite you, I know you're used to coming Monday nights. Keep coming Monday nights, we've got a great group here. We're going to be having a special Wednesday night class. My mother's yard site, her anniversary of her passing is being commemorated and bringing a big rabbi in here on December 14th, which is a week from this Wednesday night. Not this Wednesday night, but a week from Wednesday night. We'll have a big crowd across the hall here if you guys want to come. His name is Rabbi Moshe Weinberger. He's an awesome, awesome speaker. I don't even know what he's talking about, but it doesn't really matter. I think it'll be Hanukkah related and some other things as well if you're around. It's at 8 o'clock, not 7. 8 o'clock that night. And there'll be freshmen and all that fun stuff. Speaking of which, some cold pizza left, and donuts, and drinks, and menorahs. We've got some complimentary menorahs, and we will continue to see you guys. Everyone knows that every Friday night here we've got FNL at 6:30. Oh, we have a dinner. Leah, do we have a dinner Friday night?
Yeah, dinner Friday night.
Anything special about the dinner? People want to know. People want to hear.
Yeah, Rabbi Anthony Manning.
Yes.
He's like an internationally known rabbi. Is going to be here at the dinner, and then he's going to be doing like an ode, like after the dinner, and then he'll also be giving a sermon on Shabbat Day services.
Yes, this coming weekend, if you guys are around. Friday night dinner and next day. Guys, thanks for coming. Great conversation, everyone. Thank you. Appreciate it. Adam, it was a pleasure. Sorry we didn't have you situated the other way for you to...
That was perfect. Thank you.
We'll figure out a time, my friend.
Okay. And hopefully I'll be good to come Wednesday.
Okay, go. Awesome.
Oh, yeah. I got time as well. Okay, thank you. Bye.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Donuts, anybody?
Of course, I know you are.
I'm actually
moving in depth. What do you want? Well, I never read it. I'm naked.
Let me he can come to my school instead of me.
His name is
Peter.
I obviously like acrobatics.
And he does this for a living?
Yeah, she works for NCS1.
Oh, that's, yeah, NCS, that's great.
Yeah.
Manuel?
Yeah.
Whatever, I'll look up someone on Amazon and
see.
Manu,
Andrea? Oh, sweet.
Oh, that's him.
Have a student who sit on college students.
Yeah.
So teachers.
It's open to middle and high school class teachers.
And have 20 kids.
I'd be great. Thank you so much. I mean, that would be even better. All they care about is food, but...
What grades are they?
Mostly like 10th and 11th grades.
Hi, Rebecca. It's nice to meet you. I used to live on the other side.
Yeah.
I did a little break.